This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
During the roughly 100-year period that the Stuart dynasty reigned in England and Scotland, the upper class was made up of two overlapping groups. The nobility, those who held titles either inherited or gifted by the sovereign, and the gentry, who enjoyed nearly all the same privileges of position, but were without title. These groups, what we might call the social ruling class, took their cues from court life, from its entertainment, dress, food, and leisure pursuits. They were religious, cultured, political, and well-educated. They maintained large households and threw lavish, grand parties. But what do we know of their daily lives? How did they raise and teach their children? What did they wear? What work did they do? How many servants was typical for a household? And perhaps, most importantly, how did devotion and religious piety coexist with a lifestyle otherwise dominated by excess? Here with me today is Ben Norman, historian and author of Pomp and Piety, Everyday Life of the Aristocracy in Stuart England, which examines the lifestyle and habits of the 17th century aristocracy in all aspects of early modern life. Ben, welcome to Not Just the Tudors.
Hello, thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure.
So let's start with some definitions. What do we mean exactly by the term aristocracy under the Stuarts? Does it cover multiple groups in society, or is it simply those directly beneath royalty?
I would class them as one entity directly beneath the royal family, but then split into two camps, the nobility slash peerage and the gentry or landed gentry. So with the nobility, you've got at the very top of the pyramid dukes and duchesses, followed by marquesses, then earls, countesses, viscounts, viscountesses below them, and then at the bottom, barons and baronesses. And then with the landed gentry, you've got at the very top baronet knights below them, esquires below them, and then below them you've got gentlemen, which is quite a vague term. Technically, the nobility outranked the gentry, but I believe that the two became quite meshed because of their shared status and privilege in this period. Both sets equally. Sometimes the gentry were more wealthy than the nobility. They both possessed high offices in government, in local government. Almost all of them had a coat of arms, which was quite useful when trying to figure out if a person I came across was or wasn't an aristocrat. A significant portfolio of land and property was another big one. I tended to discount people that didn't have a country house or a London townhouse. And yeah, just local and national influence. All these people had both a kind of national presence, but also a local presence as well, be it law of the manor or in law enforcement, etc.
And you're giving a sense that the nobility and gentry have a sort of increasingly blurred line between them in this period.
Yes, indeed. And I think it was Margaret Cavendish. She was talking about her father, who was technically a gentleman. He wasn't a member of the nobility. But she was arguing that actually his status and particularly his wealth was far greater than many noblemen and noblewomen. So there was definitely a blurring of the lines in this period, I would say, yes.
So give me a sense of how an aristocratic household was run. Were the typical roles for household staff, for example?
Yes, so there was very much a pyramid of employees in operation in aristocratic households, where we might familiarly see a butler in the Edwardian or Victorian period. In the Stuart period, there was the steward, who was the main guy and looked after all the employees beneath him, save for some of the female employees. Housekeepers would do that a little bit later on. He held great influence in the household. He was often very well respected by the families that he served. He was in charge of wages, looking after the estate, running errands for the master of the household. Below him, you had a butler, confusingly, which in this period was more akin to perhaps an Edwardian or Victorian valet. And they were in charge of shaving the master, preparing his clothes, cleaning him, etc. Then below that, you've got the footmen, which we might not recognise as footmen from later periods. They probably wouldn't have been liveried at the start of the Stuart period, but as you go on, they do start to wear outfits. Very much in the name with them, they started off running messages to and from great families, hence footmen, and delivering gifts. And if an aristocratic household went somewhere, they travelled along foot beside them.
It's interesting, in the Tudor period, we actually have lots of the sort of high aristocrats have their servants in livery. So I wonder if it becomes something that then the lower servants, as it were, are wearing. But certainly, you know, the Duke of Buckingham or whatever would have his servants in a livery in the 15 teens or whatever.
Yeah, I guess possibly in terms of these people called the landed gentry, they are bettering themselves, and with that comes outfits. It's almost this idea of the insignia of an aristocratic family would be reflected in servants' clothing. But certainly with the Duke of Bedford, who's quite a big character in my book, there's some kind of a renaissance in the way that he outfits his footmen and also his postillion and people that managed his coaches. It all comes back to almost treating the aristocratic family as a brand. It was a brand name that they wanted everybody to know about and recognise.
And you were saying that there are certain distinctions between genders at the time. Were the jobs restricted by sex? So you've got men as coachmen or gardeners or whatever, women as maidservants, perhaps?
Yes, so you would never have a female steward for a start. That was always a male role. Obviously, footmen were male individuals. Housekeepers were invariably female. And theirs is an interesting journey in this period because they very much start off as almost carers of masters and mistresses. Often their family members, maybe a daughter that hasn't been married off or a kind of elderly aunt, they will look after the household. But increasingly, you get larger numbers of maidservants coming into aristocratic households. And that's where the role of the housekeeper really does change to what we would probably recognise more today. She had the roles of doing needlework and still tending to the mistress of the house and to a certain extent running parts of the house. But her role becomes much more looking after the maidservants that start to appear. And that's very much the case with, I think, a lady called Mrs. Upton at Woburn Abbey. She starts off as a housekeeper, but in charge of needlework and taking care of the whims of the mistress. But then you see this influx of, I think, about 8 different kinds of maidservants coming in. And she takes on responsibility for looking after those maidservants.
And would the servants have all been white and English?
They would not have. Mostly they would have been. And this is one of the things I certainly wasn't aware of. There were quite a large number of French people who worked in aristocratic houses in the Stuart period. Certainly the greatest number from continental Europe were French people. So you've got French nursery maids, I think, in the Russell household in the late 17th century. Ralph Verney hires a French gardener. And there are people from Wales. I think one lord down in Sussex has a Welsh page who runs away. But you also have black servants, which I found really fascinating. Going all the way back to the start of the Stuart period, Richard Sackville, 3rd Earl of Dorset, had a number of black servants in his employment. And John Rearsby, he takes on a guy from the West Indies somewhere. it's probably not accurate to say that they were picked for their skills alone. There was this idea that bringing in people from foreign lands gave a sense of exoticism and made aristocrats look as though they were well-travelled and cultured. So there was a method there. But I just found it fascinating that they were in the households of the elite at all in this period, and that it wasn't really an uncommon thing.
Yes, and it seems that that should be better known. Can I ask you about child rearing? In terms of raising children, how were babies cared for? Presumably they were using wet nurses.
Yes, they were. A baby is born, a wet nurse is drafted in, often a local woman of no great standing. Occasionally, we have records of aristocratic grandmothers having a go at breastfeeding the child, which I find very interesting. And some cases of mothers breastfeeding their children as well. I think the daughter of Anne Clifford, Countess of Dorset, she breastfed her child certainly for part of its immediate infancy. And then after that, they are weaned and a dry nurse or a nursery maid comes in to see the child through their kind of early years. And they'd be in charge of feeding the child, looking after the child, minding the child. Not necessarily always 100% good at their role. There's one instance of, I think, Hugh Cholmley from Yorkshire, a knight as a young infant. His nursery maid wasn't watching him at one point, and he proceeded to fall out of a first-story window, I believe. So they could be remiss, but obviously entrusted with great responsibility, and mothers did choose carefully for both wet nurses and dry nurses and nursery maids.
And were children typically educated in the home? Do we see differences at this point in time in how boys and girls were taught?
Yes, definitely. Home tutoring was still very much commonplace, and you see both girls and boys having tutors. In the early 17th century, you see some aristocratic boys being sent off to different educational institutions to be educated, including the big ones are, and these are for the kind of noble sons, Eton, Harrow, Winchester. But then there are below that a succession of pretty decent grammar schools for maybe lesser sons of the nobility or sons of knights, baronets. But they're very much still a mix of the two, and it's quite common to see either a child being tutored at home for the majority or being tutored at home first off and then going off to school to complete their initial education.
Let's think together a little bit about fun then and leisure activities. What were common leisure pursuits for the aristocrats?
Aristocrats got all kinds of fun and mischief, sometimes to the despair of religious commentators. Most country houses would have had a bowling green, and aristocrats really enjoyed playing bowls. And you have records of bills where they're paying for jacks and bags to put them in, and they were quite invested in that sport. Tennis was another one, still not how we would imagine it today, played indoors with rules that we probably wouldn't recognise.
Real tennis, in other words.
Yes. And we see towards the end of the period, aristocrats starting to build their own courts. I think the Duke of Bedford potentially built a tennis court at Woburn Abbey in the late 17th century. At the Restoration period, so this is a great moment of profound change for the aristocracy, really. After Cromwell's rule, the theatre comes back, horse racing comes back, and the aristocracy love both. They love going to the theatre in the 1660s. It's seen as a fun activity, but also makes them appear cultured. They love going horse racing, and gambling plays into that. They love placing bets. Some of them are massive, and some aristocrats lose huge amounts of money, but that doesn't stop them. They love playing cards. They love playing dice, again for money. And there's a wonderful story of a christening that was going on in a townhouse in London. And the group of women who were supposed to be guests were playing a game of cards, I believe. And they broke up their game long enough to see the infant christened, but then went back to playing cards very soon afterwards. Yeah, all about games, all about fun. A lot of male aristocrats would frequent brothels. They'd nip down to the River Thames to see what was on offer in terms of women. Sometimes they would host sex parties, for want of a better word, in their own properties. And this would cause rumours to abound and would distress wives, understandably. You've got more fun outdoor games, like I think Lady Anne Clifford and her husband play a game called Burley Breaks, which involves couples chasing each other for some kind of end, but they had a lot of fun doing that. And then the big one is obviously hunting. Aristocracy loved hunting, loved the buzz of hunting, loved having people over to hunt, and also enjoyed hunting with the royal family as well. It was all about prestige and the thrill of the chase and development of their skills as well. In the early period, you see mainly deer hunting in the big parks, in the country estates. But as the period goes on, more and more hunting parties going after foxes. And certainly there is a palpable shift in the primary material where by the end of the period, you're seeing fox hunting a lot more than deer hunting. And it could be quite a dangerous pursuit. Lots of written records of aristocrats falling off their horses, some of them falling into ponds, some breaking their necks, and some even dying from their injuries. It was inherently an occupational hazard of that pursuit because it was such a fast sport and quite violent at times and like lost in the moment.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue checkmark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Hello, host of Dan Snow's History Hit podcast here. History isn't just dates and facts. It's about the incredible stories that shape our world. 3 times a week on my podcast, my expert guests and I bring you extraordinary stories of heroism, discovery, mystery, and power. Expect tales of lost tombs, daring escapes, power-hungry rulers, and those determined to bring them all down. If you're a history lover or just looking for a good tale, you'll want to check out Dan Snow's History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
When you mentioned plays, one thing I was wondering about, in the 1660s, of course, you've got that reopening of the theatres after 20 years or so of being closed, and that huge demand for new plays. But how much was going to the theatre about being seen rather than seeing the plays?
I think a lot of it was about being seen and not actually taking in what you're going to see. You have this kind of explosion after the return of Charles II in terms of, I don't know, it's seen as the great rejuvenation of indulging in fashionable pastimes, being seen out. And I think certainly when you look at things like Pepys's diary or Evelyn's diary, that kind of pursuit, I believe, is much more about being seen by others, to be acquiring knowledge, being where everybody else is, and looking cultured as well. There's a funny passage in Samuel Pepys's diary, who arguably you could class as a member of the gentry. I chose not to. But there's a moment where a very famous aristocrat from Ireland, I think, walks into the theatre and everybody stops watching the play and is instead just totally invested in this big chief noble man from Ireland coming in. So it's very much about keeping up appearances, who's there, which outfit is better, is that dress better than mine, whose wig is the fairest. I think the contents of a play may oftentimes have been put on the back burner, but that's not to say that the aristocracy didn't take in the plays that they watched. There's definitely records of, especially women, which is very interesting, coming back from a play and having taken in its message or its story or whatever, and recounting it to their husbands and being quite enthused by it. So there's a mix, but there is definitely a sense of keeping up appearances as well.
You mentioned about wigs and dress there. Can you give me some sense of the kind of silhouettes we would see at this time? Because I know the Stuarts is only a sort of roughly 100-year period, but there are huge changes of style over this period, aren't they? And they're quite different from the previous Elizabethan shape that most of us would recognise.
Massively. And I would argue that the change in dress and appearance is one of the biggest changes to take place in the identity of the aristocracy. At the beginning of James I's reign, as you would expect, everybody is dressed in late Elizabethan clothing. So you've got men in the classic doublet, jerkin and hose outfits, which everybody would be familiar with in countless portraits of that time. For women, you have the bodice, skirt and gown, I believe. That sticks around pretty much until the end of James I's into Charles I's reign, and indeed through the Commonwealth Civil War years as well. But it's really at the turn of the Restoration, this is a huge turning point for so many different reasons, that clothing alters unrecognisably. Charles II comes back from France, where everybody is wearing wigs, men, I should say. So naturally, men start wearing wigs in England. So it's a thing that comes in about 1660, a little bit afterwards. And with that, you have the three-piece male suit, which kind of takes over from the doublet, jerkin, hose, get-up. And that goes right through to the Georgian period. And that doesn't change for a long time. But obviously the biggest difference with male appearance is you don't see their hair anymore. Everybody is wearing a wig. The hairstyles were short in the reign of James I. They got longer in the reign of Charles I. And then they just disappear entirely under the wig in the reign of Charles II.
And for the men also, the beard disappears, doesn't it? As the wig gets longer, facial hair seems to evaporate.
It does. So the beard gets smaller and smaller. And then with the arrival of the periwig, they think the look is best suited to having a clean shaven face. So from 1660 onwards, all highborn men have a clean shaven face. With the women, you have these massive hoop skirts, farthingales, in the reign of James I. And there's a wonderful anecdote of the noblewoman strutting about in her farthingale in Holland in maybe the 1610s. And she's made fun of because of her huge skirts. They were big kind of statement pieces, but very fashionable. And I don't think she would have cared. I think it was people of an inferior rank who were making nasty comments about her skirt. But the point is that as long as her equals thought that she was fashionable and comely and attractive, that's all that would have mattered to her. And that definitely comes across in that story. That disappears by the reign of Charles II. It kind of gets smaller and smaller. And then in the later 17th century, you have these kind of more free-flowing dresses that aren't so compartmentalised. I think called the mantua. That was a very popular dress worn. And instead of consisting of various different elements that might make you feel a little bit constricted, it was very much a kind of free-flowing, silky outfit. But interestingly enough, by the time we get to the reign of Queen Anne, so going into the early 1700s, you get big hooped skirts appearing again. So it comes full circle. And I just think that's quite a unexpected coming full circle. But at the same time, I think it's quite poetic.
It would be impossible to talk about the Stuart era without talking about faith and religion. So how did religion inform an aristocrat's daily life and practices?
I believe that religion was crucial to an aristocrat's daily life, even though they may not have always shown it outwardly. And you have the Marquess of Halifax, I think, summed it up perfectly. He's talking to his daughter about how she should lead her life. He said that through all the ostentation and pomp and get-up of the aristocracy, what life really comes down to is being pious, having faith, being respectful to others, including your employees, having a strong moral compass. Everybody in 17th century England were expected to go to church at least once a week, and aristocrats were no different on a Sunday. But because of their status, wealth, prestige, often they had the means to pray multiple times, even in one day. A lot of them had personal chaplains and individuals like Hugh Cholmley. He'd have morning prayers at 6 a.m, I think, so a very early start, with all his servants as well. Servants were included. And if servants didn't attend, they could get in trouble for it. Religion in the day-to-day life, in terms of designated times of the day set aside for prayer, was very important. Even people serving in high office, Lord Chancellors, I think it's Anthony Ashley Cooper in the later 17th century, this huge work schedule, very busy day-to-day life, serving the monarch, serving the nation, would still have regimented times of day where he would pray with his family and with his servants. So very important. And it comes through aesthetically as well, which I found really interesting, going through inventories of aristocrats' goods, which are such a useful source for understanding the aristocracy. You'd find great tapestries woven with biblical depictions that would have been very prominent in a household. You find pictures of Christ, allegories. You find religious symbolisms carved into tables, on bed headboards. It wasn't just an internal thing, it was also a very visual part of their life. And obviously, a lot of, certainly the larger households, would have their own chapel as well. So there was that kind of depiction as well.
Finally, Ben, I'd like to ask you a question, which I suppose goes to the heart of why you decided to write this book. What can an understanding of the life of an aristocrat tell us about the social, religious and cultural mores of the Stuart era?
I think it tells us that there was great social inequality at work, for one thing. Even though there was concerted efforts by aristocrats and government to make it not terrible poverty alongside such extravagance, and very extreme extravagance in some cases, especially with the higher members of the nobility, it's great to study the aristocracy for their own sake. And part of the appeal of the book was to just probe how outrageous they were. And they were pretty outrageous, a lot of them anyway. But through that, it does show that society was very much one-sided. But another big thing is this presence of religion, religious observance, it never being far away from anybody in society. And aristocrats weren't exempt from that and didn't feel exempt from that either. They were very much part of it and were happy to be part of it as well, for their own ends as much as for more widely social ends. So those are two of the big things that I took away. And also, definitely, the Stuart period sees a rise from start to finish in, I think, aristocratic extravagance in different forms. It's a constant presence. But I think the Restoration, as I say, is such an important time. And there is a real shift. The dress, the eating habits, what have you, were always quite lavish, over the top. But you really do see it become a whole different kettle of fish as you get to the 18th century. And that really is reflected in things down to the way they look. It's so easy to tell looking from one end to the other. It's just so outlandishly different. And there's things that have happened between James I's reign and Queen Anne's reign in terms of fashion changes and more excessive living, I think are very easy to discern through looking at the aristocracy.
Well, thank you so much for giving us a bit of an insight into what it was like to live as an aristocrat in the 17th century and what a very different world it was, mostly indeed. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thanks to you for listening to Not Just the Tudors from History Hit. And also to my researcher, Alice Smith, and my producer, Rob Weinberg. We are always eager to hear from you, so do drop us a line at notjustthetudors@historyhit.com or on X, formerly known as Twitter, @notjusttudors. And please remember to follow Not Just the Tudors wherever you get your podcasts, so you get each new episode as soon as it's released.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
History is full of extraordinary people, the Tudors being just a handful. In my latest film on History Hit, we meet Bess of Hardwick and go inside the incredible house that she built, a house that defines the elegance and grandeur of the Elizabethan age, a house fit for a woman who climbed to the top of the Tudor social ladder. To find out more about the life of Bess and many more fascinating figures from the past, sign up via the link in the description with the code TUDORS for an exclusive discount.